Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Last week, the FCC chair announced the elimination of the Fairness Doctrine. And this hour of our program, we're going to be talking about the history of the Fairness Doctrine and the state of media in the USA. And our guest is Nicholas Johnson. That name will be familiar to many of you. He was on the Federal Communications Commission as a commissioner from 1966 to 1973. He is a guy with many talents and has had many jobs: academic and law professor, government official, school board member, public interest advocate, administrator, manager, and corporate representative, writer, lecturer, TV and radio performer, politician, lawyer, public health, computer, and telecommunications policy specialist. You're probably familiar with at least one of his books, How to Talk Back to Your Television Set, published in 1970, and Test Pattern for Living. He's also the author of Second Priority, A Former FCC Commissioner Speaks Out. Are We There Yet? Reflections on Politics in America. What Do You Mean and How Do You Know? An Antidote for the Language That Does Our Thinking for Us, and Virtuosity, 8 Students in Search of Cyber Law. He was born and raised in Iowa. He returned to Iowa in 1980. He has clerked for former U.S. Supreme Court Justice Hugo Black, and he has held 3 presidential appointments, including administrator of the U.S. Maritime Administration. And he is our guest this hour to talk about the Fairness Doctrine and civility on the airwaves. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Nicholas Johnson, hello. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thank you for asking me, Kathleen.
I should also say that you have 7 children. How can you do all of this in a lifetime? I mean, your resume is unbelievable.
Well, you mean how long did it take me to write it? you know more about me than my mother ever used to know.
Well, you've done many things in your life, sir, but I want to know how you got on the cover of Rolling Stone.
Well, it was easy. I just opened the magazine and there I was.
Why? Why did they put you there?
Who knows?
You don't know?
No, I was carrying on a national debate in the pages of the New York Times and elsewhere with Vice President Spiro Agnew. He and Nixon took the position that the sole cause of problems in America were was the music that the young people were listening to, and I took a somewhat different view of the matter. And I suspect that may have had something to do with it.
Just think about the music that is played today. They thought the 60s were bad, huh?
Right. Well, it goes back to the Greeks. They always thought it was worse, you know, than it had been in the past.
So let's start with a history of the Fairness Doctrine. It goes way, way back, doesn't it?
Well, it really does. And it goes back further than even you may have imagined when you said that. And if I can truncate a semester-long course into 90 seconds, I'd like to review a little of that for your listeners to kind of put this into context, because it has a history that really goes back to the founding of our nation, long before anybody ever imagined there would ever be radio and television. Jefferson's notion of self-governing democracy, he thought this thing through and required that we have schools so that people could handle information, libraries so that the poorest American could have access to the riches of kings, postal rates that would permit books and magazines and newspapers to be sent around the country cheaper, and opportunity for people to vote once they'd become informed, and a First Amendment to make that possible. Now, the First Amendment simply says Congress shall make no law abridging freedom of speech. That doesn't help us very much, and particularly in a case in which 2 people are arguing that their First Amendment rights are at stake. And that's what we have with the Fairness Doctrine. The broadcaster is saying, hey, this is my station. I have a right to speak and say whatever I want to say. And the members of the public are saying, hey, yeah, but you're a monopolist. You're operating under a government license and grant, and surely the broadcasters can't be the only people in America who have a First Amendment right to speak. So what do you do when both people are arguing they have the First Amendment right? Well, you go back to what are the purposes? What are we trying to accomplish with the First Amendment? One thing is to permit people to govern themselves. Another is the notion of search for truth, that the more opinions you have out there, the more likely you are to come up with the right one. A third is the checking value that the media can provide, finding things not just the government, but large corporations and other institutions are doing that ought to be reported to the public. And a fourth is what's sometimes called a safety valve, that if you give people a right to speak, they may not be as intent on throwing a brick through your window. And finally is what might be called self-actualization, that there's just a personal benefit to being able to formulate thoughts and speak them and so forth. Mm-hmm. So you take a look at the demand of the broadcaster that they be the only one who gets to speak, and you compare it against all those. Is that going to be best for self-governing, for search for truth, for having a checking value on abuses, safety valve, self-actualization? Well, probably not. But that's the question. And when the Supreme Court of the United States confronted the question of what the Fairness Doctrine, whether the Fairness Doctrine is constitutional, they said, a license permits broadcasting, but the licensee has no constitutional right to be the one who holds the license or to monopolize a frequency to the exclusion of his fellow citizens. There is nothing in the First Amendment which prevents the government from requiring a licensee to share his frequency with others. And what they meant by that is that the licensee might have the opportunity to broadcast on Monday and Tuesday, but somebody else would have the opportunity to broadcast on Wednesday and Thursday on that frequency. And so they're saying if the government can have that kind of sharing of frequencies, it certainly can have the First Amendment. Can have the Fairness Doctrine. And they went on to say, it is the right of the viewers and listeners, not the right of the broadcasters, which is paramount. In other words, what we're trying to accomplish here are these purposes of the First Amendment, and that includes informing the public, and that means they have to have a range of views, because broadcasters don't own their stations in the way that they might own a farm or a house. The very first section of the Act provides that they are operating a license but with no right of property in that license. And just as most members of Congress are reelected, most broadcasters get their licenses renewed. But that doesn't mean that a member of Congress has a constitutional right to be reelected or that a broadcaster has a constitutional right to go on broadcasting on that channel. Okay, now, what is the where does the Fairness Doctrine require and what does it not require? It's probably a good idea to get out of the way a lot of the things that it does not require that its critics are always mentioning. And it should be noted in this connection that this has never been to the extent the word liberal or conservative means anything anymore. It's not a doctrine that has been espoused by liberals and not by conservatives. The Fairness Doctrine, when it was under threat, was supported by the National Rifle Association, the right-wing Accuracy in Media, Phyllis Schlafly, as well as the ACLU, Ralph Nader, and so forth. It's been recognized by anybody who's ever been felt that their point of view is being trampled upon and excluded, that they want to have at least some modest check. Okay, now, is this sounding more and more like a semester, Kathleen, and less like 90 seconds? Do you?
It's good to have the information, Nicholas.
It is your program, after all.
It's all right. You're the guest.
All right. Well, number one, the Fairness Doctrine does not require that the broadcaster be fair in the sense that a third grader might use that expression on the playground. It would not permit driving Rush Limbaugh off the air. That's one of the conservatives' favorites, because it doesn't apply to personalities. It doesn't apply to individual programs that are syndicated to stations. It applies to the station. The station has to have some balance, but an individual program does not. So Rush Limbaugh would do just fine under the Fairness Doctrine. It does not require all points of view. It does not require equal time. It does not require that any given individual be given airtime on the station. The FCC does not initially choose the subjects or the content when discussing those subjects or the viewpoint that must be expressed when discussing those subjects prior to the broadcaster programming. It's the broadcaster who makes all those choices. And depending on how they make those choices, that may trigger the Fairness Doctrine, and we'll get in a moment to what it requires. Another major important point is that the FCC does not enforce the Fairness Doctrine. That is to say, it does not monitor the programming of broadcasters. The Fairness Doctrine was solely driven by complaints from individual members of the audience. And I remember at one time we had close to 70,000 complaints, and we had three people in the Complaints and Compliance Bureau to investigate them all, and they traveled in pairs. So the enforcement was never very strict. You don't lose your license as a result of the Fairness Doctrine. Okay, so how does it work? A complaint, what the Fairness Doctrine requires is two things. And I would note these are two things that a broadcaster or a newspaper publisher would want to do anyway in order to maximize profits, even if they did not care about their service to their local community. They would do this to make money. A professional journalist would do it anyway because it's simply good professional journalism. And what is that? It's a requirement that you cannot, if you're running a broadcast station, merely be a jukebox with commercials. That you have to deal with some of the controversial issues in your community. You get to pick them. You don't have to have broadcasting about all of them. But you cannot operate your station simply as a one-note propaganda outlet if you're going to put material on the air. You have to have dealt with some controversial issues of public importance, and in doing that, you have to present some range of views on that particular subject. It's not equal time. It can be as out of balance as 4-to-1 or 10-to-1. It doesn't require any particular speaker. Broadcaster gets to pick that. Doesn't require a particular forum. One thing can be a editorial. Another can be a guest on a show. Or you could make time available in some other way, or whatever. So that's what the publisher, broadcast station licensee, or journalist would want to do. If you want to have readers, if you want to have listeners, you want to have subjects that have some controversial element. You don't want boring subjects, all right?
Right.
And in order to cover it and get people to read the paper or listen to the program, you want to have a range of views. So it's not a very onerous notion. It's supported, or has been in the past at least, by all segments of the political spectrum. Now, finally, I should note that what did the FCC do recently that caused you to call me? They did the equivalent of going to the cemetery, looking around for the headstone that said Fairness Doctrine, digging up the coffin, opening the lid, and looking in to make sure that it was still dead. They've not been enforcing this for over 20 years. So what they did primarily was respond to the president's effort to convince the broadcasting industry that he was going to lessen regulation. He was going to get rid of these fruitless regulations that were inhibiting growth of the economy and inhibiting jobs programs. So, for example, the way we regulated BP's offshore drilling was just too onerous. And if we hadn't have regulated them so severely as we did, why, they might have done more offshore drilling and employed more of people to work on those offshore rigs. And similarly with Massey Coal. I mean, they only had some 700 or so safety violations. And when you start enforcing those safety regulations, you know, it costs them a little bit of money. So the president wanted to convince the business community that he was going to reduce regulations. So Jenikowski, chairman of the FCC, as I say, went out in the cemetery and checked inside the coffin to make sure the fairness doctrine was still dead, and then held a press conference and announced that he was. So that's my semester-long course in however much time this has been.
Thank you. Nice job. But let's go back to when it started to die. If it had support from people from very different political viewpoints and different organizations, why didn't it just stay alive?
Because of the political power of the broadcasters, and it had always been an organizing mantra for the National Association of Broadcasters, that the Fairness Doctrine is an imposition on the broadcaster, and we want our First Amendment free speech rights, and we got to do away with this. Well, broadcasters are very powerful because all anybody else was doing back in those days was giving the $50,000 in cash in a brown paper bag to the elected officials. But what then happened to the $50,000? Well, 90% of it went to the broadcasters to buy time during the campaign for the elected official. But what the broadcasters charged for, they could give away for free. A local television station could send a reporter and a camera to Washington, D.C., and two or three times a week have a little news item on the local news featuring the local member of Congress. Well, that was a pretty nice thing, and you didn't want to do away with that, and somebody's going to do nice favors for you like that. You don't exactly want to give them a poke in the eye with a sharp stick, and if all they want is a repeal of the Fairness Doctrine, well, what the heck? So I think that had a lot to do with it. I don't think it was rational, well thought through. I think it was primarily a effort at political organizing and satisfying demands of the broadcasters.
And yet the way it's been played over at least the last 15 years, if not longer, is a movement on the part of conservatives who have said the press has an incredible left-wing bias. They point to the newspapers in the country. They point to the main television networks in the country and say that it's just been unfair. We need to get rid of it because you're silencing conservative voices.
Well, I challenge anybody to get in a car and drive west from the Missouri River to the border of California and continue and turn their radio up and down, the AM radio up and down the dial, and continue to say that there is a liberal bias in the media.
I agree with you. I don't think there is. I don't think there is either. I don't think there is either. The thing that is troublesome to me, and I worked in commercial radio for a number of years and did talk shows, and we were very careful about, particularly when there were elections going on, major elections, that all candidates, except for very fringe candidates, were interviewed and that they did have equal time and that we did very careful analysis of what their positions were and we had debates, et cetera. What has happened to any kind of regulation of that now? Can you have just one candidate who you support on the air and skip all the rest?
Well, talking as long as I just did, it's hard now to say that I oversimplified. But in point of fact, there are a number of doctrines besides the Fairness Doctrine that are in some way related to it. One is the personal attack doctrine, that if you attacked somebody, you had to give the person attacked an opportunity to come on and respond. The Fairness Doctrine did not put a right in any named individual, but the personal attack doctrine did. And there was a political editorial doctrine that was similar to that. And what you are now talking about is the only one that has survived, and that is called the equal opportunity doctrine. And that is that during an election, if you put one candidate for office on your station, you are obliged to give an equal opportunity. That, strictly speaking, is different from equal time, because you can have somebody on the evening news for 5 minutes and give the other guy 5 minutes at 3 a.m. Well, that's not an equal opportunity. But that you have to give an equal opportunity to everybody else running for that office. And then there are a lot of details about, who was a candidate and so forth and so on. But that's what you were talking
right.
about and complying with.
And if you are a media conglomerate and you own a lot of, in the same community, you own perhaps quite a few television stations, radio stations, et cetera, does that apply to each one of those stations, or can you get by having somebody on another radio station?
No, it would be an obligation of the licensee with regard to the station in question.
Do you think that we need a fairness doctrine right now? Was it silly to get and was it damaging to the country in terms of an informed citizenry to get rid of it?
I think it was terribly damaging to get rid of it. I think there's absolutely no chance of getting it reenacted now. Obama and the FCC are clearly on the side of its repeal. The broadcast industry is. The conservatives and that control the House of Representatives are. And what we would need to have would not necessarily need to be precisely what the Fairness Doctrine was. In many ways, it was inadequate. I think there may be better ways to accomplish the same thing. But I do think we should put on every broadcaster's wall the line from the Red Lion decision I read from: it is the right of the viewers and listeners, not the right of the broadcasters, which is paramount. A reminder of what this is about. This is property owned by the American people. Not everybody who wants a broadcasting license can have one. It is a public resource. They are, in effect, public officials as much as a member of Congress is, and they have obligations to the community in exchange for the right to have the monopoly right to broadcast on that frequency in that locality. This is, after all, one of the few businesses in America where if you go to compete with a television station on its license, you don't just risk bankruptcy, you risk being sent to Leavenworth. It's one of the few areas of commerce where the government will put your competitor in prison. So this is not like every other area of business. But that's what the Equal Opportunity Doctrine was about. That's a recognition of the power of this industry, and it was a recognition that a congressman was very prescient. Back in the 1920s, when the predecessor of the Communications Act was enacted, the Radio Act of 1927, and he said on the floor of the House, when they were very concerned about ownership standards, which is another aspect of all of this that you and I haven't yet talked about at all, and he said that this is the most powerful weapon that can be wielded in a republic. And bear in mind, this was when a lot of people didn't know what radio was, these voices coming out of a box. But he'd figured this thing out. And that when such a weapon is placed in the hands of one person or a single selfish group is permitted to either tacitly or otherwise acquire ownership or dominate these broadcasting stations throughout the country, then woe be to those who dare to differ with them. Well, woe be to us indeed. But he saw that back in the 1920s, and a lot of folks haven't even grasped it today when it's ever so much more obvious than it was then.
Nicholas Johnson is our guest this hour, visiting professor now at the University of Iowa College of Law, former commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission, 1966 to 1973. We are talking about the death of the Fairness Doctrine, more accurately, the elimination of the Fairness Doctrine, which officially happened last week. I'm Kathleen Dunn. We have one line open if you'd like to take it, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. To your calls, starting with Jim in Milwaukee. Hi, Jim.
Hi. I'll talk fast. First point is that this illustrates why we need to elect to nominate and elect real liberals in the primaries. What I think we live in is not a democracy, but a bullcracy where people are propagandized to think that they're free when they're not. And an example some quick examples. Iran-Contra was revealed through the Arab press. If Van Jones even signs a petition on 911, he gets dumped out of his job, let alone discuss the issue. And in the current situation in the local areas, the Milwaukee Journal won't even take a call on conservative talk shows if you're good and you're against their point of view. And we have a current issue with a man who was very abusive in the Supreme Court, and it's portrayed as if he and the woman that he abused are equally at fault of this. And the implication that they want us to draw is that, well, they're all of the politicians are crooks, and we have no choice in the matter. We just have to accept things the way they are. What we can do, we can try to work to expose ideas through alternative networking, and we also have to try to boycott people that are discriminatory and don't give both sides. And in the case of Obama, I'll vote for him if he's a Democrat nominee, but I'm not going to lift a hand to help him, which I did do in the last election. There has to be consequences for behavior.
Nicholas.
Well, Jim's on top of it. I don't know. I am add much to that. He's recognizing that the power to control the media is the power to control the society, and most officials know that, whether they're operating inside a fascist state or a so-called democratic state. There are various ways of controlling the media. But you notice when you have revolutions, and we've had a few here recently, where does the action take place? It's around the entrance to the television station, because whoever controls the media controls society, and we've largely turned that control over to advertisers in terms of the commercial media. They talk about diversity, but in order to actually get – it doesn't make any difference how many radio stations you have. If they are all operated to maximize profit, owned by conservative Republicans, and broadcast conservative right-wing talk shows, you can have 100 of them or you can have 2 of them. But 100 of them doesn't mean you have diversity. The way you get diversity is having alternative systems of organization and funding, like Wisconsin Public Radio or like the Pacifica radio stations, WBAI in New York and KPFA and B in Berkeley and so forth, or WNYC, which was owned by the city of New York, WCFL, the Chicago Federation of Labor station in Chicago for many years. You have different institutions, or, of course, the stations that are owned by educational institutions or licensed to educational institutions, because educational is sometimes different from public radio and television. Mm-hmm. That's the way you get diversity. And so I don't find convincing the argument that we have so many more radio stations than we used to have if they're all running the same programming.
Thanks, Jim. Greg in Madison, hi.
Hey, this is Greg, and I love your gift. I love his discourse. I appreciate the pedagogy. I think he was a little unfair regarding Obama, because the Massey enforcement action was actually first in history for the government to shut the company down. My concern regards how he would actually make the case that there's no fairness doctrine when even something like Fox News or Rush Limbaugh can legitimately claim to present opposing points of view. Rush Limbaugh always has his token liberal that he brings on. And it slanted 1 to 20, but that was the criteria he gave. And the same thing, they can legitimately claim to be performing a public service. So even though I know Robert Murdoch has wagged the dog many times, why wouldn't Fox or Limbaugh, can't legitimately claim that they support the fairness doctrine?
Well, it would be subject to a complaint and an evaluation if we had a fairness doctrine, which we don't. I did point out that even if Rush Limbaugh didn't have people who he would argue with and suppress and talk over and so forth, that the fairness doctrine only applied to balance within the total programming of the station. So the problem would be when you have Limbaugh followed by Hannity, followed by Gordon Liddy, followed by, you know, just an unending stream of one conservative talk show host after another. That would create a problem for a station under the Fairness Doctrine, if we had a Fairness Doctrine, which we don't. But yes, that would be one of the arguments that Rush Limbaugh and others could make, is that although what Jim said in Milwaukee, that the station actually would not put you on the air if you expressed a contrary view, well, that, of course, would be a different matter.
Yeah. What about that jukebox that plays commercials but doesn't do any kind of public interest programming? Are those stations pretty much free to do anything they want? What if there's a weather emergency? What if there's some kind of emergency in the community?
Well, yeah, there was a famous case in Minot where Clear Channel owned the station, and they didn't have any human beings there. It was all run by remote equipment, and they had a chemical spill disaster, and people had been told to tune into their local radio station, and they did, and they got nothing at all. But that was always one of the great arguments of the broadcasters back when I was on the commission, is, oh, look, you know, we're so important because we provide the local community information about what's going on locally. Well, a lot of them did, and certainly they did back in the 1920s when this all began, and you'd have a station, they were called mom-and-pop stations, because it'd be a couple that would run the station and do the electronics and be the on-air personality and sell the commercials and gather the news, and they did the whole thing, and they really were a community service. They were doing exactly what the Congress had in mind when they passed that Early Radio Act.
And those of us who have been in radio for a long time, Nicholas, many of us dream of working at just such a place. Impossible now, but it wasn't many years ago.
Well, you came up with the answer, and that is you left the commercial side and came over to do the Lord's work at WPR. See, that's one option if you guys have.
I thought I was always doing the Lord's work.
Even when you were working in commercial?
Yes, sir. I did a similar kind of show. That's what I'm saying. I'm old now, so I was doing essentially a kind of public radio show on commercial broadcasting, and we did fine.
Well, you look like a very young lady on your webpage. I'm not sitting there in the studio with you, so I can't say. But,
the glories of radio.
Yeah.
Yeah. You sound like a really young guy, too, Nicholas.
Oh, listen to that.
Yeah.
Here we go. You're matching me.
Thanks, Greg, for the call. Hugh in Milwaukee. Hi, Hugh.
Hi. One of the things about being older, as I am, is I can remember the era of the Fairness Doctrine and the very dull programs, because radio stations often were unwilling to put on a controversial guest, because then they might have to put somebody on from the other extreme. Now and then somebody got on, but it was rare, it was dull, and as television came in, and the programs, the westerns and the comedies and so forth, moved over to television, radio seemed to go into decline. It's only with the end of this restraint, which you call the Fairness Doctrine, it's only when that ended that people could get into programs where they could express themselves on various stations. You have Rush Limbaugh those programs. You have what we'll call the urban stations, where black nationalists can express their opinions. I find it far more interesting that way. Public radio, which is, of course, government radio, is, I think, clearly, from everybody's point of view, a liberal organization. You had the firing of Williams because he made a comment, not even on NPR, but on Fox Television, that they found so offensive that they fired him. And what did he say? That he felt a bit uncomfortable when people get on an airplane with Muslim garb.
All right, let's hold it there, Hugh. You got a lot on the plate here. What about his point that radio and television became much more engaging, a lot more viewpoints, when it was completely deregulated?
I disagree with him, but he may have access to a lot of data on that would document his position. I do not to document mine, but... For the reasons I explained, I think that the lack of FCC monitoring, the reliance on complaints, the procedure that involves sending the complaint to the station for it to answer, the very few number of fairness complaints that ever went anywhere after that. Normally the station's response was accepted by the FCC and that was the end of it. Nobody lost a license for the violation of the Fairness Doctrine alone, certainly not for a single violation. I just don't think it had that much impact, and it was supported by those responsible for putting on the news programming, who might be confronted by the advertising vice president and say, hey, look, you got to take those programs off, or you're criticizing used car dealers. They buy a lot of commercials on our station. And the news person could come back and say, hey, look, I'm sorry, but we're required to do that. I think there were plenty of the values were different. That is to say, what the audience would accept in terms of incivility, in terms of sexual innuendo, and so forth, that has evolved obviously over the last 70 years, and so that certainly has changed. I would acknowledge that, but trying to tie it to the creation or enforcement or death of the Fairness Doctrine, I think it truly is a bit of a stretch.
Thanks, Hugh, for your call. We'll take more phone calls in a moment. Nicholas Johnson is our guest this hour. Who better to have on the program when the Fairness Doctrine has been officially eliminated, as it was last year, than somebody who was on the Federal Communications Commission, former commissioner, from 1966 to 1973, and has written widely about media issues. He's written a number of books, and he he's done all kinds of things in his life, so he has served in the public interest in many capacities. We're looking at the history of the Fairness Doctrine, why it has not been enforced for 20 years, what are the effects of not having a Fairness Doctrine, should we have continued to have a Fairness Doctrine. That's on the table this morning. 800-486-8655. Our email address, if you would like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Jean in Wauwatosa. Hi.
Hi, good morning, Kathleen. Fantastic guest again. A lot of thoughts I have. This is, I guess, one reason, I'll ask a couple of ways. Has this all been occurring as far as the final elimination under the Obama administration, and is the impetus and then the implementation of getting rid of this been under the Obama? So to tie with that, is this another example of Obama caving for approval by extremists? I often wondered why he put the Fox News in the coveted first row of the press corps, and I used to justify it by he wanted to keep his enemies closer, but it's hard to understand exactly why. And finally, to your guest's most recent point, the advertisers really do rule these days, and for, this is an example of why Beck is off the air on TV, because the advertisers bailed, which is a good thing. So
Nick,
that's all.
Thanks, Jean.
That's in a nutshell.
That's a lot. And comment from you, Nicholas.
No, this did not take place under the Obama administration. The most recent thing, it started under the Reagan administration, the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine. Congress tried to pass a law making it very clear that they did want the Fairness Doctrine. In fact, they embedded it in the Communications Act in 1959 in Section 315 that also contains the Equal Opportunity Doctrine, but that was rejected. I mean, that's was part of the Supreme Court's recognition in the Red Lion decision, but was ignored by Robert Bork, then a U.S. Court of Appeals judge. and the FCC, which decided that they both knew better than the Supreme Court of the United States how to interpret the Constitution. But in any event, the assassination of the Fairness Doctrine took place long before, long before Obama was born, but certainly long before he was president of the United States, and that what they've just done within the last week or so, I characterized at the top of the hour as the equivalent of going into the cemetery, looking around for the headstone with Fairness Doctrine on it, digging up the coffin, raising the lid, looking in and making sure the Fairness Doctrine is still dead, and then putting it back in and covering it up with dirt. So if Obama can take neither the credit nor the blame for the abolition of the Fairness Doctrine, only for the confirmation that it's still dead. Kathleen, you mentioned your email address. May I mention a web page, my web page address, for anybody who'd like to follow up on all this?
Sure.
Find out more about it. There's all kinds of stuff linked from there. Nothing of commercial value to me, but it may be of informational value to others. It's simply my name .org, NICHOLASJOHNSON, all one word, nicholasjohnson.org, and you'll find all kinds of stuff there.
You will. Thank you, Gene, for your call. Let's go next to Kathy in Eau Claire. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, my question is, what can an individual citizen do? This is very disturbing.
Well, I'm pleased that you're disturbed. Then we've served a purpose. And I wrote a book called How to Talk Back to Your Television Set, which is available for free off of that nicholasjohnson.org, that has some ideas in it, but a lot of those are no longer very useful because of what's happened. In a concession to the shortness of remaining time, if not to the shortness of life itself, I'll give just a couple suggestions. One earlier caller mentioned advertiser boycotts. When I was chair of the National Citizens Committee for Broadcasting, we identified the 10 bloodiest corporations in America, linking the advertiser to the programs with the most violence. And we could put 300,000 letters on a CEO's desk, and that brought about, I believe, the only time that levels of violence actually declined in television programming. So one thing is to work with the advertisers, who are, after all, calling the final shot. And the other is to utilize the alternative media that are now available. You may have public access channels on the local cable distribution system that you can program for free and put your own stuff up there, and that's not the equivalent of owning the CBS network, but it's participating in the local dialogue. You've got the print stuff available to you with letters to the editor and so forth. You've got letters to members of Congress. And now with the Internet, YouTube, blogs, you can post audio and video. And I have an active blog also where I deal with political subjects called From D.C. to Iowa, but you can get to that from the website I mentioned. And there, the blogosphere has had a real impact, and certainly Julian Assange with his WikiLeaks had an enormous impact, whether you think it's negative or positive. So I think there's still a lot of things that people can do, even though more and more power has been consolidated into fewer and fewer hands. Both in terms of the distribution of wealth in this country, which is now a greater gap between the top one half of 1% and all the rest of us than ever before, and in terms of media power, when the FCC gave in to pressure from the large media conglomerates to let them acquire more and more media outlets. So it's a lot tougher now than it was 70 years ago, but there's still a lot of things we can do, and ultimately, of course, as we've learned from the Arab Spring is just simply getting out in the streets. And ultimately, they've got to have some response to that.
Doesn't it bug you? One of the things that bothers me, and I've just stopped listening to a lot of commercial radio, but when you talk about power, it seems to have affected individual shows now, too. Somebody ought to do a study of how much more Rush Limbaugh talks now than he used to 10 or 15 years ago. It's as though people get the airwaves and, I mean, I can see how it might be appealing. Here you are, and you got this show, and you talk all day, and you tell people what you think, and then they ought to think what you think, and then what you think becomes all important. Even on liberal or conservative television shows, they use the same people all the time. It's the same voices, so we know what everybody thinks. And there's a whole world out there with all of these viewpoints. Instead of, with an expanding media, getting more and more and more viewpoints, we're getting, you know, mostly white guys shouting what they think about things all day long.
Well, that's right. And there have been studies done of public television as well, for those who think that it has a liberal bias, that there's very little on there of what one would think as far left, radical positions, that they tend to prefer government officials, corporate officials, whatever. And there has been some data and documentation of that, so that there is not as much diversity out there as one might hope
right.
for. Amy Goodman's Democracy Now!, which is certainly available for streaming on the Internet, if not on your local public access cable, will have a range of points of view and issues discussed that you simply don't get anywhere else. And there are more and more websites and news sources on the Internet that can do that as well, from all points of view. But it's harder to get out there than when we had the three dominant, ABC, CBS, NBC, and everybody was watching one of those. And then we've got the problem of splintering of the population and people listening primarily to those things with which they already agree,
right,
rather than being exposed to other views, and there's all that conversation
right.
to be had.
Yeah. Kathy, thanks for the call. Wayne and Holman. Hi, Wayne.
Good morning, Kathleen.
Hi, Wayne.
Good morning to your guests. Go Brewers.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Our show's
tonight,
coming up.
7 o'clock tonight, hon.
All right.
I'm enjoying this show immensely. I'm a conservative, but I like WPR because particularly I enjoy Kathleen Dunn. And I'm not trying to get favor with you, but that's the way it is. My question is, though, Fox News gets railed against quite regularly. And some of the commentators on Fox News are Juan Williams, Mara Liasson, Alan Combs, Bob Beckel. These are not conservative names in the news media. And if I want liberalism, I can go to MSNBC, CNN, CNBC. I can read the Atlanta Journal, the Boston Globe, the New York Times, the LA Times. So there's plenty of room for everybody, I think. And I guess, what am I missing? Is this just an attempt to reduce the hour time that Rush and Sean get, or is there something else going on? And I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks, Wayne.
Well, Wayne reminds me of every 4 years in a day. I normally work for the Democrat, but I always pick the Republican, who's my the one I think would do the least harm as president. And one of the things that I found attractive about Mike Huckabee on one of those occasions was he said, "I'm a conservative, all right. I'm just not angry about it." And Wayne strikes me as my kind of conservative, somebody who's conservative but isn't angry about it. And I think so long as you're sampling all of that, fine. One of the links from my webpage is called Global Media, with links to Le Monde in Paris and People's Daily out of Beijing and New Straits Times out of Malaysia and so forth. The NPR is much better now than it used to be, but it used to be the only way I could find out what was going on in the world, and in large measure the United States as well, was from BBC Radio, which I still listen to probably more than almost anything else. But I think you have to read widely. Walter Cronkite once said as much. He said, "Anybody who's solely dependent on one source is going to end up being woefully uninformed." or misinformed. And we've got statistics and data on that too, with regard to our going into Iraq and what people believed based on what their source of news was. But I think if you do what Wayne's doing, if you really do get out there and sample a variety of sources, which I certainly do, I think you've got a reasonably decent education and analytical ability going into it all, I think you'll come out just fine. But the problem is, an awful lot of people pick a single source and they stick with that. Then there's a lot they're not going to know.
Oh, we're out of time. I feel like we can call you and have you on all kinds of subjects. So I hope you'll join us again. It was really fun.
Well, anytime. You were really nice to ask me, and it's always nice to be in Wisconsin, even if only by way of a telephone line.
Yeah, and well, it's nice to hear you in Iowa, too. That's where I went to school. I love Iowa.
Oh, really?
Yes, sir. It's a good
place. We can get Wisconsin Public Radio often just off the air, too, but I usually do it with streaming.
Yeah, thank you. Nicholas Johnson, former commissioner of the Federal Communications Commission, 1966 to 1973, visiting professor at the University of Iowa College of Law right now. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for production. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for on-air producing.